KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. From issuing tribal IDs to administering health care, tribes work every day to secure control over their own destinies. As the nation marks a half century of official self-determination, we are at the Tribal Self-Determination and Self-Governance Conference in Phoenix, Arizona, to hear directly from tribal leaders and others about the gains so far and the outlook for the next 50 years. We're live from Phoenix and we'll take your calls right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Forest Service staffing at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center in Juneau, Alaska remains uncertain due to turmoil from the Trump administration's federal firings. But there will be 8 people working at the glacier in a different role as cultural ambassadors employed by the local tribe. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
At the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, cultural ambassadors are learning how to best represent Tlingit stewardship and connections to the glacier to the roughly 1 million tourists slated to visit this summer. Sani Liana Wallace sets off down the walkway towards Deep Creek.
We'll never stop talking. Join the crowd. We're talking about plants. So Lee, who's been here a while, is going to show me a plant that he wants us to work on.
They're part of the group of ambassadors who will be at the glacier when tourists start arriving in less than 2 weeks. The Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska program started last year as part of a co-stewardship agreement the tribe formed with the U.S. Forest Service. It will allow people like Shock Dintach, Jonah Johnson, to teach visitors about Devil's Club, or as it's called in Tlingit, because there's more to it than meets the eye.
It looks like it's just a harmful plant, but it's really our medicine plant.
In February, a wave of federal firings left one remaining Forest Service staff member at the visitor center. In a typical summer, there are about a dozen on site. Some of the fired staff have been rehired, but there are rumors they may lose their jobs again. But while that's up in the air, the cultural ambassadors are moving forward with their plan to staff the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. Lee Miller is returning for his second season. He says he thinks all the staff at the glacier will be spread thin this year. Miller says he loves representing the Occoquan and bringing the joy of the natural world to the visitors.
You can pass it on to them. You're coming in and you say, okay, I just saw a porcupine out on the meadow there. You know, just point it out to them and they'll ask you questions.
Miller's family has been here for thousands of years, but he'll be greeting people who are seeing the glacier for the first time.
Just interacting with them and watching them, you know, it's just, that made the whole season.
And the 2025 season begins April 14th. When the first ship arrives. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
A group of education leaders from tribal organizations testified at a U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hearing last week against the dissolution of the U.S. Department of Education and for the protection of programs that support Native students. The hearing followed an executive order President Trump signed last month to close the department. Rosita Kahani-Worrell, president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, spoke about the persistent lack of education funding, especially in Alaska, given the state's fiscal situation.
Despite these challenges, we can confidently state that through our culture-based programs that we have integrated into schools with DOE funding, we have witnessed measurable educational achievement among Native students, as well as improvements in their social and emotional well-being.
Sydna Yellowfish is director of Indian education at Edmond Public Schools in Oklahoma. She says programs also help Native students who are homeless or in foster care.
These challenges such as suicide and substance abuse, most recent bullying and sexual assault that we have worked with our students, I feel like we are obligated to address these challenges and work with our students and our families as the best that we can.
Senator Lisa Murkowski co-led the oversight hearing. She says the department's programs help the government fulfill its trust responsibility. Murkowski says that one idea to work around the department closure would be to transfer the programs to other agencies and to administer funding through the states. However, Murkowski and several witnesses pointed out that such a transition could be detrimental to tribal sovereignty and lead to additional bureaucratic hurdles and delays. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce, broadcasting live from the Tribal Self-Governance Conference at the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona. We're here in front of a live audience today to talk about the progress in tribal self-governance. The conference is celebrating 50 years since the start of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. It set the foundation for so much that came after, including the ability of tribes to establish their own health care, their own law enforcement and justice systems, and to develop gaming and many other forms of economic development that create jobs and revenue for tribal citizens. We will go back to the early days when the seeds of self-determination were first planted. We'll learn about how it's changed over the years, and we'll look ahead to some of the opportunities and hurdles for the future. The legislation championed by President Richard Nixon a half century ago is now part of the support structure for every tribal citizen. We'll hear from people who are working every day to protect and strengthen self-governance and self-determination for future generations. We'll hear from our live audience here in Arizona, and we'll take calls from listeners at home. Reach out to us with a question or comment by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. And for those of you who are here in the audience today, we will have a microphone, and you will be able to ask questions as well that will be broadcast on the air. So please, we encourage participation not only from our callers all around the country, but also from you folks who are taking the time out of your busy day to sit with us here while we do a live broadcast here from the event. Now let's go ahead and meet our guests. Joining us here from the Tribal Self-Governance Conference in Chandler, Arizona, to my far left is Ron Allen. He is the chairman of the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe. They are located in the Puget Sound area west of Seattle, Washington, if you're familiar with that part of the country. Chairman Allen, it is an absolute pleasure. Welcome back to Native America Calling. Big round of applause for Chairman Ron Allen.
Thank you, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here and looking forward to the conference and the events this week.
Absolutely. Also joining us today is Jay Spahn, seated directly to my left. He is the executive director of the Self-Governance Communication and Education Tribal Consortium. He is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. He's based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jay, it is a pleasure as well. Welcome to the show.
Wado, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's great to have both of you on the show today here live. And we also have a third guest who is joining us over the telephone from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Many of you know her well, Laura Harris. She is the executive director of American Indians for an Opportunity, and she is a citizen of the Comanche Nation. Laura, hello and welcome back to the show. It's great to have you on the line.
Madhuaway, Sean. I'm very glad to be here and very honored to be on this panel with the chairman and Jay.
I feel honored too. I feel privileged. I'm just really excited to get this conversation started. We don't always do live broadcasts. Usually we are in the studio and we're mic'd up and we've got headphones. And to be here in front of a live audience and see so many eager faces and Native people from all over the country just here representing, it's truly a privilege. So let's go ahead and get this show started. Chairman Allen, I want to begin with you because you are somebody who has had the responsibility to govern for many, many years. You've been around since the early days of the Indian Self-Determination Act. You've seen its evolution. You've seen the changes. Maybe talk a little bit about just
what the change has been, and just going back to the early 1970s and where we are today, here it is, 2025. What have you seen? What has impressed you most? And where are we at right now with regard to Indian self-determination and governance?
Well, thanks for the question, Sean. It's been quite a journey for all the tribes, you know, since the 70s when Richard Nixon signed into legislation the Indian Self-Determination Act, which started the new movement of empowering tribes and recognizing tribe sovereign authority and governance. We also need to take it into perspective that going back further, last year, 2024, was the 100th anniversary of the Indian Reorganization Act, 1934. And then shortly after that was what they called the Snyder Act, which were resources that tribes were still using back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even today, quite frankly, tribes can still use the self-determination or the Snyder Act grants. But when you stop and you think about from the 70s into the 80s, the tribes started contracting, 638 contracting and granting, and started getting these different resources from HHS, IHS, BIA, and Interior to start running our own programs. And then in the 80s, it became revealed that the system wasn't working well. Down here in Arizona, there was what they called the Arizona Republic brouhaha over mismanagement, abuse that was going on with the federal agencies with regard to BIA programs, IHS programs, and just lots of challenges. Lots of hearings happened in the late 80s based on the House and the Senate saying, okay, tribal leaders, what's going on? Okay, if this is not working, what should work? You know, the grant and contract approach. And we were saying what we need to do is rethink how that the federal government's resources are being transferred to the tribal government. It should be transferred so that the discretion and the management of these different programs for natural resources, public safety, education, healthcare, and so forth, we should be doing it. And so what happened in the late 80s and early 90s was a pilot initiative by about 10 tribes to give it a shot to see if it could work. It could. And in 94, it became the first formal permanent legislation with regard to self-governance, what they call Title IV of the Self-Determination Act. Title V became the section of the Indian Self-Determination Act for IHS. We're now pursuing Title VI, which deals with all the other agencies that are in HHS. Meanwhile, on other tracks with the HUD and with EPA, et cetera, we're continuing to move forward with those agendas in the other federal agencies. What's most important is that it has strengthened tribal governance to prioritize how these programs should be run by the tribes with respect to the unique needs of their communities. So here at Gila River is what they need here for their people, how they should structure their governance and their operation. Jamestown will do it differently. Navajo will do it differently, and so forth, all the way through the 574 Indian nations. So it's it's empowered us to start managing as governments. Quit managing as contractors or grantees. That's not who we are. We're governments. And so we start functioning like governments. And it forced us to start to develop our political legal infrastructure, how we embrace the priorities and needs of our community. So things have changed dramatically in the last 30 years of self-governance, but in the last 50 years of the Indian Self-Determination Act as well.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Allen. Jay, I want to bring you into the conversation now. I think a lot of times we use the terms self-governance and self-determination interchangeably, but they actually have very different meanings. Explain those to our listeners.
Sure. Thanks for that question. Self-determination was the authority that was initially provided under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act in 1975. I think that the era kind of leading up to that was a really interesting one, and I know another one of our guests, Laura, will be able to talk intimately about that era. But, you know, you really started seeing tribes you know, the late 1960s, early 1970s, just whenever tribes were looking at termination era policies ending and looking at a new approach and a new relationship with the federal government. It was really interesting. You saw the return of Blue Lake to the Taos Pueblo people. You'd see the Menominee Restoration Act and Menominee Nation getting its restoration after termination back. And you start to see like this really big change. And then whenever Kennedy signed the Indian Self-Determination Education Assistance Act, it was for self-determination authority. At the time, I think that the policy was very well intended. However, its implementation had some challenges. So federal agencies were not necessarily on board with the direction and the policy of the administration. So they started putting up barriers and burdens that were hindering tribes from being able to truly see the impact of taking over the programs and managing them on their own. And so that's when Chairman Allen was talking about that sort of the tribal leaders getting this frustration about how this policy wasn't being implemented the way it should be. And then you started seeing this, you know, fraud and corruption with the use of federal funds, and it all kind of came together to where tribal leaders decided we need to take this in our own hands and do a different approach. And so they came up with the idea of tribal self-governance. So that's different from self-determination, and that self-governance was really looking to dismantle some of those barriers that had been put up by the federal agencies. So tribes would truly be able to manage these programs, redesign the programs, and take the resources and figure out how is it best for us to solve them. So we kind of explained it that they're both really good tools. They're both really good authorities that tribes have. And a lot of tribes still use self-determination contracting extensively. Almost all tribes have at least one self-determination contract. Over 380 tribes have a self-governance compact. But self-governance compacting is the improvement of self-determination. And so it's taking those resources and being able to redesign them without having federal interference. So tribes are in the powers in the driver's seat. You know, we kind of think of it a lot of times that tribes will do self-determination first, build the capacity needed to then take that next step to fully take it over. So these are two very different mechanisms. They're both great, both still in use extensively throughout Indian country.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Allen. Thank you, Jay. We're about to take our first break here in just a moment, so I want to give a shout-out to our listeners all across the country. 1-800-99-NATIVE if you would like to join the conversation. We've got our phone lines open at our main studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Producers are standing by. They will take your call, and we will hear your call at our live broadcast here in Chandler, Arizona. And for those of you folks in the audience, if you have questions, if you have comments, if you have insights, if you have anything that you'd like to add to this discussion, you can do so in just a few moments. We'll have a floating microphone here in the audience as well for you to participate. So again, for the listeners at home or at work or wherever you are, listening in your favorite tribal radio station, listening to your favorite public radio station, listening to your favorite community station, the number is 1-800-99-NATIVE. That gets you through to our producers. You can share your comments on the air. And for those of us who are here at the conference today, just raise your hand, make yourself known, and we'll get a producer over to you. We'll get you a microphone in your hands here in just a few moments. So again, we're going to take a short break for 2 minutes, and we will come back and continue this great conversation with our three guests today here on Native America Calling.
As federal money for tribes enters a new, more unpredictable era, philanthropy is more important than ever. For both the donors and the benefactors, philanthropic giving could play a much bigger role in Native healthcare, cultural capacity building, and the arts. We'll get a look at the new direction for Native philanthropy on the next Native America Calling.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Hey, Neo.
This is Native America Calling. I am your host, Sean Spruce, and we are broadcasting live today from Chandler, Arizona. We are just getting this discussion started. For those of you who would like to join the conversation, listening all over the country, 1-800-99-NATIVE is the number to call. And I want to bring Laura Harris into the conversation. Now, she's joining us over the telephone. She's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she is the executive director of American Indians for Opportunity. And Laura, again, thank you for joining the show. It's great to have you. I wish you could be here present, but even though you're able to join us over the telephone, it's wonderful that you're able to participate. And your family goes back many, many years with regard to Indian self-determination. I know you were very young. You were a child when the law was first passed. But if you could talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in a home where this issue was at the forefront of probably so many dinner table conversations, and both of your parents being so heavily involved with political and legal issues impacting Native Americans. What was that like for you, Laura?
Well, thanks, Sean. I really did have an unusual upbringing. My parents included us in their work, and so our dinner table was usually full of tribal leaders and activists, and there was always a conversation going on. And I remember, I think I was about 9 or 10 years old, when at the dinner table they were talking about what terminology should be used, what was going to be accepted, self-determination, sovereignty, and self-determination really won out. But I think what I take away most from growing up in that era and being a part of all of the activism that took place is that Native Americans did this themselves. You know, Nixon didn't wake up one day and say, wow, I think I ought to give some land back to some Indian tribes and give them a little self-determination. He believed in it. He was a great supporter of Native American issues and self-determination, the idea of self-determination. But it happened, you know, many, many years, like the chairman was saying, this has been decades, if not centuries, of activism and advocacy that has led to this era of self-governance. I was telling somebody the other day that when I picture Native American activists, I picture beehive haircuts and little cat glasses and buzz haircuts and dark black frame glasses, because that's what Native Americans activists looked like to me when I was growing up in the 60s, and that's who came to our house. And, you know, even all the way back to the Continental Congress, the Haudenosaunee government sent representatives to the Continental Congress, and we've been lobbying the federal government for as long as the federal government has existed. So it's not anything that anybody gave to us. It's that these thousands of Native American activists who really brought these things to pass.
Laura, you're going back to National Indian Youth Council and some of those early days with the Red Power movement. And yeah, I think we all remember the buzz cuts and the black frame glasses. I know I saw a lot of those growing up as well. Chairman Allen, I want to go back to you because, of course, we're living in really just, you hear terms like unprecedented, a situation we've never seen before in modern Indian country, massive federal cuts, massive layoffs, just a lot of executive orders coming down from Washington, D.C., challenges facing tribes, challenges facing self-determination, challenges facing self-governance. What's your message right now to all those people here in the audience, those listening on the radio, and everyone attending this conference, tribal leaders and others who have concerns, they're worried, they've got questions?
Well, thanks, Sean. First of all, I want to do a shout out to Laura and tell her mom, LaDonna, hi, because I go back to her mom and her dad, Fred, who helped with the legislation move and helped our movement forward. So, and I'm glad that she's carrying the torch that they established back in the day. You know, the Indian country is a resilient set of communities. We have great pride in our heritage. We have great pride in our identities, in our culture, in our traditional ways of life, and so for many generations, America thought that Indian country would just be absorbed by America and sort of become assimilated, right? Termination. And those eras was just era after era of failure. And when the Self-Determination Act took place, it moved us progressively forward. But NCAI, back in the 1940s, 44 to be specific, you know, was they were in a threat back then. And then there was just constant threats against Indian country, but the resiliency of tribes, the tribal leadership, the various warriors over the different eras have always stepped up. And so the experience that we're having right now, we call Trump 2, if you will, it's a little different than the Trump 1 era, of which we had certain challenges. But we've had other challenges from other administrations, the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, Bush 1, Bush 2. We've been through some tough times, and we always managed to stay focused and stay united. As tribes become more and more successful, it's easier for us to be distracted, because success breeds higher expectation. Success breeds, you know, variances, priorities with your time. And so when any country starts getting threatened, then all of a sudden we come back together again very quickly, because we're indigenous people from east to west and north to south, and we will unite. But we will get through it. It is a challenge at where we are now. But the biggest answer is approach is we're the answer, we're the solution. You know, self-governance works. We're okay with decentralizing, but decentralize and move those resources to Indian country, and then we'll take care of our communities, Indian, non-Indian alike.
Thank you, Chairman Allen. We're going to go ahead to an audience member here seated in the fourth row. Sir, if you could go ahead, introduce yourself and ask a question. But if you could, keep your questions concise, because we do have limited time. We have breaks scheduled, and we also have other issues with regard to our producers in Albuquerque. So thank you.
Thank you. Tony Davis, Sayoso Medical Center on Navajo. We are a 638 program, and I've got about four questions. One is, you talked a little bit, Chairman, is programs that are hurting. How would you address the law enforcement issue in tribal communities? The second one, 638 organizations. Here in Arizona, we formed a 638 organization, and we hope to get tribes and pueblos involved from Albuquerque up to Santa Fe involved in that program as well. And we finally got I do want to put a shout out for our own hospital, Traditional Healing. We finally got 638 approval through Access here to do CMS a healing on that. And the other thing is, thank you for a lot of good information. It's going to be a long week. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, public safety first. We're always underfunded, from the law enforcement, the boots on the ground, to all the way through to the incarceration, detention facilities, capacities to be able to help our people stay safe. Department of Justice has a whole bunch of programs as well. So when you look at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they have the Office of Justice Services. And that's where most of our funding comes through, their base funding. But we need to, through self-governance, combine the Department of Justice programs with the Department of Interior BIA programs, so that you can decide what's the best way to use all those programs. They have multiple purposes. It's not just the cops and the equipment that necessary, the dispatchers and what have you. You need, and the justice systems, you know, for the basic justice system, the appellate system that every tribe has. And so we need to start combining those resources. There's never going to be enough. But you want self-governance is let us take those programs together and combine them.
You know, the sad part is related. The prison system has better health care than our native health care system.
Yeah. And, you know, going to your last point about the question on the health care issue, for health care, we're finding if we take those resources and bring them home, that we can do a better job. Now, one of the threats that we have right now is third-party collection from the Medicaid, Medicare. We need those resources in order to have the resources necessary to recruit and retain the kind of professionals we need, the fundamental practitioners, the nurses, the administrators who know how to run clinics and hospitals. And so we need to bring those programs all together and combine them in a way that makes a difference. I will say, you know, on your 638, remember now, 638 and self-governance are just legal instruments to transfer funds from the federal government to us. Tribes can choose whichever way they want. It's their prerogative. If you want to be a direct service tribe, you still have that option too. Today, it's not a good option.
The other question, kind of related to 638, we just went through a whole up to the Supreme Court with the contract support costs. Can you comment on how we can get other tribes to be able to do that as well?
That's exactly right. Contract support is essential for these compacting approaches that tribes do, including the 105L for, you know, leasing for your facilities that you use to carry out federal programs. The objective has been and continues to be to move those functions that should be mandatory and not on our budget so that we free up more resources for the basic needs in the BIA, IHS, et cetera.
How would you make comment in regards to the BIA education program on what they should be able to look forward to?
The workforce for the detention incarceration facilities?
BIA education.
Oh, education. Well, this is an interesting challenge we have. In BIE, there's definitely, just like the other programs, there's not enough money in the system in terms of the way that we calculate the resources that are funding for the BIA and Indian school system. For categorically, from the teachers all the way to the administrative operation, those are just basically are covering the cost of busing, getting them to and from school, quite frankly, or the protection to have security around those schools as well because of the crazy stuff that's been going on throughout America. And we want our kids to be safe and teachers to be safe as well. So we don't know if they're really going to be able to do what they think they're going to do to dismantle the Department of Education. But we do know that at a minimum, that the resources that are dedicated and have been dedicated to our school system for our students needs to be preserved. And we would like to get it bumped up without a doubt. But I personally think that we need to make sure we're consolidating those resources in Department of Education and in the Bureau of Indian Education to be more successful. It's never enough. I'm telling you, we get the 411 from the principals and the superintendents in Indian schools, and the need is overwhelming. Not enough teachers per student, et cetera.
Thank you, Chairman Allen. Appreciate that question from the audience. Jay, I want to go back to you. I'd like to get your insights and what's your message with regard to the current political climate, and how well do you think the non-tribal public, as well as folks in Washington, D.C., really understand the concept of self-governance as it applies to tribes?
Thank you. So I think that a lot of the priorities that we're seeing coming out of the Trump administration right now are really focused on local control, local empowerment, and reduced bureaucracy, more efficiency, effectiveness. And that is completely in line with what self-governance is about. This is taking those federal resources, decentralizing them, sending directly to the tribal governments that are serving their communities directly. So I think if it's done correctly, that this could be some authority that we've been fighting for a long time that we could see coming down the line. We've been in discussions with the administration, with the Hill, trying to explain to them how self-governance aligns with these key priorities and how it's a proven success. So tribes have 30 years of self-governance authority where they've proven they can be more efficient and more effective than the federal agencies. So I think that we have a really good kind of platform, and that we hope that the administration will take this and learn from the success of tribes for the last 30 years. And like Chairman Allen said, tribal nations are the solutions. That we know how to do it. We know how to decentralize the federal government. We know how to change that bureaucracy level. We know how to cut red tape, and tribes can just do it a lot more effectively. As far as the knowledge level, I think that the general public, as well as folks in D.C., still don't have a good understanding of what tribal governments do and what they are. A lot of times that we do advocacy, we are reaching out, and that's really a lot of the first questions. Is when we're talking about tribes taking over programs, you get kind of a confused look on people's faces of like, what do you mean? Like, tribes have their own governments? Tribes are operating programs? And so there's still a lot of education that's needed. As an organization, we recently created a docuseries called For Our People, where we go and travel around the country and we highlight the success of tribal nations and show how they're being innovative and successful in implementing their own programs. It's been a great tool. There's been screenings that we've had agencies show to their staff. We've had Hill folks show it on their committees. I've had universities incorporate into curriculum. So it's a really good way to kind of educate the general public, which is the first step. Everyone needs to understand what a tribal government is and how effective and innovative they are.
All right. Thank you, Jay. We've got a couple of minutes before our next break. We have just enough time to take a question, I think, and just keep your comments brief. And we might have to go ahead and answer the question coming out of the next break. But go ahead, sir. Please tell us your name and what's your question for our panel today?
I'm Arnold Broward, Jr. I'm from Barrow, Alaska. First of all, I want to give kudos to our Point Hope community. They landed their whale today under our sovereign government management program, co-management program. And I just want to give kudos to Point Hope right now.
Right, right. Yeah.
And my question is on the to increase privatization of our tribal courts on BIA services that have failed. I think that would be enhance our village's development economically and for our communities, for our housing programs that are held in hostage because BIA is not performing the services they should provide for our communities. Thanks.
All right. Jay, you want to field that one? Chairman Alley, whoever.
Well, if you haven't been to Alaska, Barrow, Alaska, you can't get much further north than where Arnold comes from. That's way north of the Arctic Circle, I got to tell you that. On the public safety, in states like Alaska and California, we call them PPL 280 states, where the local enforcement is supposed to be covering the cost of the public safety and the needs of their communities. It's been a huge problem for us for generations since they established that legislation where the states tried to preserve their public safety authority. And so for us at self-governance, we have to come up with creative ways which we can help them under whatever authority that we can generate to help protect their communities. Some of the greatest atrocities of violence against Indian women and natives is in Alaska, quite frankly, frankly, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is very slow at responding.
Thank you, Chairman. We've got to take another break. Stay with us, listeners on the air. Phone number to join the conversation, 1-800-99-NATIVE. We'll be right back.
Support by AARP. If someone asks you to buy gift cards to pay off debt, it's a scam. Imposters will claim your Social Security number's at risk, or your utility company will stop service due to late payments, or you won the lottery and only need to pay some upfront costs. They'll say the fastest way is to buy gift cards and share the numbers on the back. Anyone who tells you to pay a debt with a gift card is a scammer. More information on gift card scams at aarp.org/giftcards.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support by Alaska Growth Capital. The Bristol Bay Marketplace is now open. Bristol Bay Native Corporation shareholders, descendants, and spouses are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Skuktash, For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
Welcome to Native America Calling. This is Sean Spruce. I am your host. We are here live at the annual Tribal Self-Governance Conference here in Chandler, Arizona. We've got a great discussion going on. We have three guests on the show today. Chairman Ron Allen of the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe. We have Jay Spahn, Executive Director of the Self-Governance Communication and Education Tribal Consortium. And on the line in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we have Laura Harris, Executive Director of American Indians for Americans for Indian Opportunity. And we're going to go back to Laura here in just a few moments. We want to get her insights as well. But we've got a couple of callers on the line. And the first caller we have is Brian, who is listening in Anchorage, Alaska. And he's listening to station KNBA. And just a little bit of information. The parent company of Native America Calling, Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, is based in Anchorage, Alaska, and they also own KNBA. So, Brian, thank you for calling in. Good morning. How you doing?
Hey, good morning, Sean, and thanks for taking my call. I'm doing well.
What's your comment, brother?
Still there? My comment is I live here in Alaska, born and raised here. Native self-determination was what the Native Land Claims Settlement Act was all about, was to put us in a situation where we can compete with non-Native people and control our own destiny. And so this is 2025, 1971. We had the Native Land Claims Settlement Act signed by President Nixon. And to this day, we have more than 80, probably 90, almost 100% non-Native people running our corporations. I am so tired of this. I know that the people who wanted this Native Land Claims Settlement Act to roll in their graves at the way we have chosen our direction. And to tell me that we don't have engineers and business administrators in colleges now coming out who are Native people with the degrees we need is a total lie. And I'm disappointed in the people who are representing us right there. How many non-Natives are we gonna employ? How long are we going to wait to take care of our own self-determination that we're supposed to be doing? I've recently applied for a job, and it's supposed to be Native preference up here in Alaska with these subsidiaries of our Native corporations, but they don't even have that on the application. So 2 days ago, I've been talking about self-determination up here, and I'm glad you had this, because this is time. It's way past time that we take care of our own self, take care of our own future, and get non-Native people out of our corporations and back where they belong.
Brian, really appreciate you joining the conversation from Anchorage, Alaska, listening on Radio KNBA. We've got another caller. This is Eric, who tunes into the show every day. He lives in Lapway, Idaho, and he listens to the tribal station that's located there on the Nimiput lands in Kamiai, Idaho. Eric, brother, I just saw you a few days ago. We had lunch there in Lapway. How you doing? Thanks for calling in.
Hey, talk to me, brother. I'm glad you, good to see you. And I'm glad I was able to steer you in the right direction to go see the Battle of Nations basketball tournament and see the spectacle that it was. And which kind of leads me into, you know, I'm glad you have this conversation going, because something that I feel really adamant about in the fact that, you know, my family, we've been a part of politics and leadership and a part of our tribe, you know, since the 50s. And I was showing you a picture at the cafe of my grandfather, Lewis B. Holt, who was on the very first tribal council and then also on to become the tribal liaison to Senator Frank Church in Idaho, his cabinet. And so, but the thing that I think about even more so is because back in 1980, we had the Rapid River standoff where the state of Idaho tried to take our fishing rights away from us, and we fought our elders, and some are not here no longer, but stood our ground and fought for our treaty rights. And then now I think about, so there's more examples, but that's just one example, even back in 1980, that was just a decade past the signing of the Self-Determination Act. And then thinking about now and what's transpired over the times, and seeing, you know, and I do agree with the caller before about, you know, wanting to have Native representation, and then But you think about some of the things that just happened in the House of Representatives, you know, with some of those tribal leaders that are indigenous, but yet still vote in the Republican way in their thought process, and, you know, and part of the party's marching orders going forward. And so with Trump in there, I see a lot of, you know, scary things going forward, and the fact that, you know, he's doing things that haven't been done before, and it's going to put more pressure on us as Indian people. And, you know, I see what Public Law 280 does to a lot of tribal members and how it's force-fed us, you know, into where we're at now, where we have to depend on this, depend on that, but yet we have a lot of differences, you know. So I just I appreciate the comments today, and, you know, we have a big fight in front of us, especially with the Trump administration and the onslaught that he's going to be bringing forth and has done. And I just hope that we can stand our ground and protect our treaty rights and protect our people.
All right, right on. Eric Holt calling in from Lapway, Idaho, proud member of the Nez Perce tribe. We have another audience member who would like to share a comment or a question. Sir, the mic is yours.
Thank you. My name is Brandon Paya, and I am from the Paskenta Band of Nomlaki Indians, Dawenam. Good morning. My father is actually from the Havasupai tribe, so I was born there in the Grand Canyon. It's an honor to be here in Arizona today, feeling this hot weather. So as this is a question for both of you. As a tribal leader, what message could I bring back to the youth of my tribe to encourage the importance of self-governance?
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and let our panelists here who are live, we're going to let them answer that question. But first, I'd like to give LaDonna Harris an opportunity to answer that question as well. She's on the line in Albuquerque, New Mexico. LaDonna, excuse me, Laura Harris, excuse me. Laura, please go ahead and respond to our audience member who's interested in knowing what is the message to the youth that you folks are talking about there at American Indians for Opportunity.
Well, I think the other callers mentioned as well, I think one of the most important things that we can do to get through these very interesting times that are happening to us right now is to understand how we got to where we are. And as I said before, you know, it's all Native peoples who have created all these changes within the federal government. It hasn't been the federal government changing. We've changed the federal government. And we've been doing that since the beginning of United States history. The three pieces of legislation that we've mentioned today, very precedent-setting pieces of legislation that really changed forever the way the federal government works with us. That was the return of a land to an Indian tribe, the Taos Blue Lake, returned to the Taos people. That was the first time the federal government had ever returned land to an Indian tribe. The other was what we've been talking about, the Alaska Native Claims Act. Now, that one is controversial because back then people weren't talking about how to organize governments. And so those ways of decision making were more corporate and may not fit the folks as well as we had hoped. But there was an increase in land and money through that legislation. And then the other one was Menominee Restoration. And the people that worked on those issues, like Ada Deer, John Echohawk, Charlie Edwards, they were always in Washington working, and they were educating the decision makers. Americans for Indian Opportunity, throughout our 55-year history, because of my mother, LaDonna, really understood that most people don't understand that we retain our inherent right to be self-governing and have since the beginning of the United States and before that with treaties with Europe. But it's important to know that President Johnson was really swayed by Native Americans to create a cabinet-level council, the National Council on Indian Opportunity. It was chaired by the Vice President, Hubert Humphrey. It included members of the cabinet, Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Commerce, Labor, HUD, HEW, HHS now, and Agriculture. And then it was populated with tribal leaders, Raymond Nakai in Navajo, Willie Hensley in Alaska, Roger Jourdain, Wendell Chino, and my mom, LaDonna Harris, the only woman and the only non-governmental person appointed. But she was really helped shape how that council could work. And when President Johnson appointed Bob Bennett, the first Native American commissioner for Indian Affairs, he's very famous in his speech in when he appointed Bob at his swearing-in ceremony. He said, Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, was very well known for the way he spoke, but he said, Bob, you go over there to the Smithsonian, and you get you one of those war clubs from the collection. And this is Johnson, who's talked this way. And he said, you go over there
the
and you
treatment,
hit...
right?
Yes, you hit the heads of every department in the federal government, and you tell them that Native Americans are citizens of the United States and therefore eligible for all federal programming. That was a huge change, because before that, everything that had to do with Natives went through the Bureau of Indian Affairs only. And this time, that opened up the federal government completely so that tribal leaders and tribal government representatives could go directly to the Secretary of Energy or the Secretary of the Interior or Commerce. And then these departments, then AIO was a big help in creating Indian desks, is what we called them then. Now they're tribal offices. And we helped author some of the first government-to-government policy statements, therefore institutionalizing the roles of tribal governments within the federal system of governments. That's what people miss, is we don't know civics, and we certainly don't know about Native American history and how we're organized and how we fit in to the federal system, which is unique in the world, the way our system works. And it was Natives that did that. It's Natives ourselves who are going to be able to help our people through these difficult times. And I think understanding our history and how we did it the first time and how we can keep doing it and how it takes our constant vigilance to ensure that these rights don't disappear but are added onto. Thank you very much, Jay. Jay and Ron, it's just been wonderful to be with you. And I'll be there tomorrow.
All right.
Well, afternoon.
Laura, safe travels. Thank you so much again for joining the show. And I'm glad you mentioned the reference to civics class. And again, echoing back to our audience members' question about message to youth, Jay, I'd like to ask you, what aspect of self-governance, tribal self-governance, should be taught in every high school civics class in America?
I think that the underlying principles of self-governance and understanding that government-to-government relationship, and that this isn't something like just an authority given from Congress. This is redefining the relationship between tribal nations and the federal government, which are both sovereign nations. And something I would really recommend to youth is to, I know it sounds cliche, but think outside the box. But really, there's a quote from Ada Deer that she said, if you don't like a federal law, change it. And I think that there's too many times that we feel confined by, oh, well, this is what the law says, so we have to work within these parameters. Well, if you don't like it, then change it. And don't be scared to push for change, and don't be scared to change. And so if there's a way to improve it, then go for it. So that would be my message.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Chairman Allen, how about you?
Okay, I'm back. I think one of the things that is going to be important for people to understand is that self-governance is been a mission that all tribes have been on historically throughout our relationship with America. Self-governance is just recognizing that tribes were always a member of the family of American governmental system, from the federal to the state to the local and tribal governments. So we have this equal relationship. So we're not underneath the state and local governments. We're in a co-relationship with the federal government in the Constitution. And the treaties happened because of our sovereignty. Not everybody had treaties. Remember, there's only around 300 or so treaties that were consummated by the Senate. There's another 350 that were never negotiated, never consummated. But it recognized the sovereignty of tribes. So that's one of the most important things. And that we continue to push forward on that recognition. Yes, we are citizens of America. But we are also citizens of our governments, of our community. We're citizens at different levels of our political system. And so when you're moving from administration to administration, Congress to Congress, any country is always in an educational mode, because for the most part, you're going to the civics question. Civics never really fully recognized the role of tribal governance in this, in how civics works. And you don't even teach civics anymore. And civics is a fundamental for all people if you're going to function at a political level. And so we're educating new administrations, new leadership, and getting them committed to respect tribal government.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. Yeah, I remember taking civics back once upon a time in the 1980s, and there was no reference at all, no mention of tribal governments at all in that role. Well, folks, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. We're going to have to wrap up this fantastic conversation, but we had three wonderful guests who joined us today. Let's give another big round of applause for Chairman Ron Allen, Jay Spahn, and, of course, Laura Harris, who joined us over the phone. Big round of applause for our guests. Also want to thank all of our callers who joined the conversation, as well as the audience members who joined in the conversation as well. Big round of applause for those folks who participated. All right, and we will be here through the conference. We'll be broadcasting shows all week here from Chandler, Arizona, from the event. So we are just getting started here, and we're excited to be part of this event. Looking forward to getting to know some of you folks, learning more about what communities you're from, what the issues are, what the pressing issues that you're most concerned with. Welcome anybody. Just come up. Let's have a conversation either with me or one of our producers. We're always looking for stories. We're always looking for interesting guests. So thank you. And again, 30 years of Native America Calling, celebrating our anniversary this year in 2025. And what a wonderful way to do it here at the Tribal Self-Governance Conference. So with that, we're out of time. We're going to wrap it up. So thank you all for joining us today, as well as our many listeners all across Indian Country. I'm Sean Spruce. Stay safe, stay strong, stay sovereign.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Summer Youth Powwow to foster community relations, youth literacy, cultural exchange, and provide local community resources. Trickster Cultural Center's Summer Youth Powwow is open to the public at no charge and takes place May 31st in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at TricksterCulturalCenter.org/summer-youth-powwow-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show. Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian Country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
All right. tea and then go home. Sea lion woman, sea lion woman, dressed in green, wear silk stockings with golden seams. Sea lion woman, sea lion woman.